This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
For the first time, U.S. subscribers can stream MLB Network 24/7, including select out-of-market games.
Swing and a drive. It's deep. It's gone. Yes!
Stream minor league affiliates.
Home run number one.
Or draft pick number one.
Plus, get MLB Big Inning and live audio for all 30 teams.
Baseball can't get better than this.
Experience the game like never before with MLB Network and At-Bat, your all-in-one baseball destination. Only $6.99 per month. Visit MLB.com/At-Bat for details. Blackout and other restrictions apply. MLB trademarks used with permission.
Play ball!
It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, another tie-in to Michael Jordan and his baseball career. Obviously, the ESPN series The Last Dance has us all thinking about and talking about Jordan, and his baseball career isn't to be overlooked. His famous summer fling in 1994 with the Birmingham Barons, the AA affiliate of the Chicago White Sox, was viewed as a joke early on, but by the end of that summer, he had hit over 200, barely over 200, but remember, he was 31 years old and was in AA after not playing baseball at all since high school, and even then, not against anywhere near the competition he was now seeing. For more on what it was like to be Michael Jordan's teammate that summer in Birmingham, please make sure to check out our last episode with former Barons shortstop Glenn DeSarcina. So what Jordan was able to do in baseball really wasn't an impressive feat, even though it didn't really start out that way. The very beginning was interesting because of the atmosphere, of course. And the man who had the honor of being the first pitcher in the Southern League to face Jordan was John Courtright, a 23-year-old left-hander who had been an eighth-round draft pick out of Duke 3 years earlier. That's right, North Carolina versus Duke was a juicy subplot to Michael Jordan's first professional baseball game. Courtright, who made one major league appearance in 1995, was pitching for AA Chattanooga, a Cincinnati Reds affiliate. On the night of April 8, 1994, Courtright faced Jordan three times as Birmingham hosted Chattanooga, and Jordan went 0-for-3, striking out twice. For all the details of that famous first game, plus the story of how Courtright went up and in on the most famous athlete on the planet, and then asked for his autograph the next day, here is my conversation with John Courtright. John, let me start by asking you this. What do you remember specifically about the buildup to that first at bat, and you are going to be in the spotlight as the guy who faced Michael Jordan for the first time?
Well, the buildup was unique for me in two ways. One, the obvious that in a minor league setting, we were going to have kind of the eyes of Chicago, the eyes of the nation, watching what was his first official game. You know, as much as I may not want to say this, a lot of people forget the idea that I believe Michael played an exhibition game, maybe White Sox Cubs,
yep,
two or so days before, and thus missed the first game of what was the Southern League season. And so this was technically, if memory serves, as I age, was the second game of the 94 Southern League season.
Right.
You know, the first game, there was already a kind of momentum building in Hoover Met for that participation of Michael. And what, you know, a number of folks have to think about is Hoover Metropolitan Stadium, when it was built, don't know the exact year, but it was a Taj Mahal in minor league baseball. And so whenever you went to play in Birmingham or in Hoover, you kind of felt like you were in the big leagues anyway, because the hotel, which was made a little bit famous by Michael because I believe he stayed at a place called the Winfrey Hotel during that season, which was like, you know, for a young minor leaguer, was like a Ritz-Carlton or whatever it may be. And it was attached to a mall. So going to Birmingham to play was a big deal for most minor league players. The presence or the knowledge that Michael was going to be a part of it, you know, took it from an 8 to a 18 real quickly.
John, I found a quote from you after that first game when you referred to that exhibition game that you were watching and, you know, kind of scouting a little bit. You said you saw him swing at a 3-0 pitch and you kind of liked to see the fact that he was hacking at a 3-0 pitch. Do you recall that?
I recall bits and pieces of what I said about that experience. I have to assume, despite being, you know, in my opinion, the greatest basketball player ever and one of the most recognizable athletes, you know, of our time, there has to be a certain level of like aggressive anticipation to get something out of the way. So I would think that for him, there was a burning desire, besides his unique competitiveness, to maybe get his first hit, et cetera, out of the way. You know, conversely, I would assume most pitchers, I can speak for myself, were trying to be just as determined not to be the first one to give up that first hit.
Yeah, how much did this play into the idea of, you know, I talked to, you know, his teammates love him, and his teammates wanted him to succeed. Everybody who's with the Barons wanted him to succeed. But on the other side of this, you're a guy who's in Double A. You were an 8th round pick, and you're trying to make the big leagues. How much of your mentality at the time is, well, I'm going to show him my stuff? He's never seen stuff like this. This guy stepping off the basketball court after, you know, not playing baseball for 13 years.
I don't think memory doesn't serve that there was much jealousy or animosity, to be really frank. I think that probably there were times in a locker room where we touched on certain things that, you know, maybe this is unfair to someone who was sent back to maybe at that time like Winston-Salem because it was high A and he didn't make the Double A roster as an outfielder. But from what you heard from Barron's people, and maybe, let's just be honest, it's MJ, you accepted it a little bit differently than maybe other folks from the outside looking in would have thought.
And this must be kind of painful for a Duke guy to say about a North Carolina guy.
It was. And I think that was old school Sports Center days. And they did, and I don't have any tangible evidence of it, sadly, but I remember leaving after the game, and they did, like, remote interviews with a guy, used to be an announcer, maybe Steve Cyphers was his name, and he was on site, I believe, and they did SportsCenter interviews, and I think he, alongside Kurt Bloom, who was there on site as the Barons announcer, radio guy, I think Steve Cyphers was the one that kind of nationally, you know, brought that to the surface as a subplot, the Tar Heel versus Blue Devil, and certainly made for good laughs and good jokes all the way down from family and friends.
How much was this a little bit exciting for you? I mean, forget about just facing him, but You're a guy who's in Double A, and as I said, trying to make the majors. You're getting a lot of exposure here. People are seeing you, and I think I heard, you know, some of the Barons players even said, you know, scouts are coming to watch, and okay, maybe they're coming to watch him, but they're going to see me too. There's a certain amount of exposure you got out of this that maybe you wouldn't have otherwise.
The exposure for me was probably cut into a two or three different swaths. One was, you know, unique exposure on TV, which was still in its, I guess, maybe infant stages in terms of sports. I'm staring at a videotape, a VHS tape that my family had taped off of WGN because I think it was broadcast. And because of The Last Dance, et cetera, I'm embarrassed to say I pulled it out with a big box to put it in. So the exposure was very unique in terms of seeing or having people tell you they saw you on telecommunications that were still a little bit new in terms of the live sports. I think, too, what's an interesting story is I pitched the second game because the last day of spring training, I had been sent down from AAA to AA. So my mindset as a professional baseball player was candidly not overly excited. I was steaming hot, mad, and very frustrated with my situation. And a little bit maybe embellished, but I'm trying to part and parcel my memories together. Mm-hmm. The manager, his name was Pat Kelly, who I still speak to this day, had essentially said, hey, because of your mindset and this change, let's just throw you the second game. You're not going to start opening day. Get your legs under you. Get whatever anger you have out. We got a long season ahead, and the only one you're going to hurt by not being prepared and pitching well every 5 days is yourself. Wow. And so I pitched the second game, which obviously then changed a little bit of the course of my trajectory from a minor league standpoint. The third part of it is I was fortunate enough to have been on this major league roster for the 94 spring training. And the Reds were really good. That was the strike year. We were in first place when the game ended at that level in early August. I am far from a celebrity then and certainly now, but I had been around interesting people. We had Barry Larkin, and we had Deion Sanders, and we had Jose Rio. You know, you had been at Duke as a student athlete where we went to four national semifinals and two national championships. So I had been fortunate enough to be around some unique athletes at the highest level. So I felt a little bit more prepared, and to your point, it wasn't like overly exciting. But in review, none of them measured up to meeting Michael Jordan or facing him.
So take me up to what can you remember about, I guess it was the third inning, and he comes up to lead off the third inning. So you're warming up, you know he's on deck, you know he's coming up. What do you remember about that lead up to that?
I hadn't thrown very well. As I said, I still had a little bit of, I shouldn't be here. I'm going to prove it to the world with every pitch that I should be in AAA in Indianapolis. And if you knew me well enough from a catcher, or a manager, or a pitching coach standpoint, you could probably tell. You know, pitching is oftentimes when you talk with young pitchers, it's not throw harder, it's just throw better. And I was trying to throw harder and harder and harder. The early pitches to Michael were poor. They were erratic. And I remember a little bit, if I got behind, maybe it was 2-0 or 3-0, either his first real swing or potentially Sweeney, he had swung and fouled a ball off. Mm-hmm. And in fairness to Michael, you know, there was a lot going on. And the ball didn't have a ton of, shall I say, like juice off the bat.
Yeah.
And it kind of woke me up to the point where it's like, hey, look, there's whatever it was, 13, 14, 16,000 people here screaming and booing with every ball because they want him to swing the bat to get his first hit. That foul ball or that swing kind of woke me up to the point of, hey, look, hammer the strike zone. Despite who it may be, he's presumably not going to beat me, not only because of the odds of hitting, but because of the uniqueness of the situation. And it probably propelled me to get through the at-bat with a little bit more focus.
Yeah, he worked the count to 3-2, including that foul ball. and then a fly out to right for his first at bat. So his first at bat wasn't a strikeout, but his next two were. And one of them included a brushback pitch that, you remember that one.
Yeah, I think brushback's a little strong. As I said earlier in the podcast, erratic is more befitting of my outing that evening. But I do remember that pitch a lot. And what I've tried to tell folks through the ages is essentially this. I'm a left-handed pitcher at like 6'2". He was a right-handed hitter at 6'6 or 6'7. For me to throw a trajectory from left to right that basically almost took his head off, that's just, let's be honest, a horrible pitch by me.
Yeah.
And what I chuckle about is I'd have to go back and look, but the catcher, I believe, may have come out to talk with me because the decibel level of the crowd was, you know, rising to a fever pitch. And the catcher came out and said something to the point like, I'm not sure Michael's ever, you know, faced a pitch like that. Mm-hmm. Not that it was Randy Johnson, but you get my drift. And I remember when we went back, his feet were multiple inches further back from where he was in the previous at-bats or even the previous pitch, to the point that even with his uniquely long and athletic levers, half of the outside part of the plate, there was no way he was ever going to reach. And I chuckled to myself after the fact that, you know, that was part of opening up the zone, certainly unintended.
A couple of strikeouts and three trips. What do you remember about after the game, all the attention of just, you know, you pitched professionally for a couple of years. And as you said, you were in a big environment at Duke and around, you know, high-profile athletes there as well, even if you didn't mix with them all the time. That post-game atmosphere must have been, you know, different, unique for you.
It was, and I as I said, I think that there was an involvement with Sports Center and a couple other sports television news outlets. And, you know, look, it was whenever you pitch well, you kind of leave the ballpark on a high. I think I had exercised some of the demons, as I had alluded to earlier, that wherever you are, you just have to go pitch. Mm-hmm. And the biggest point in the aftermath was I was determined to try to either meet or get something signed mm-hmm. for this occasion. And when we got there, probably 2 days prior, a day before opening day, there was a clubhouse attendant there that had been there through the years, and I think I had actually spent the year prior in the Southern League, so I went through Birmingham a lot.
Yep.
And was one of those guys that probably through boredom would know a lot of people in the clubhouse, or Kurt Bloom. I would just chat with them. And when we got there, it was made abundantly clear there's nothing going to get signed. Don't even ask. Hmm. And so everybody's like, well, this, you know, this is a bummer, et cetera, but hey, it's only the second or third day of the season. Who knows where this thing will go? But that was made abundantly clear. So, as I said, I talked to or gotten to know people through the previous year and the previous couple of days. And I said, I got to figure this out. So an unnamed person said to me, hey, look, Jordan is going to hit tomorrow at about noon by himself on the field. And so I'm not telling you to or not to, but if you thought maybe there was an opportunity to get over and do whatever you wanted to do early, just giving you a suggestion. Mm-hmm. As a young minor league player, you know, it's not like going to Yankee Stadium. I'm not sure I want to go to the ballpark at noon at a double-A field. I'm not sure what I'm going to do all day, but obviously, Sweeney, these are unique circumstances.
Yeah.
So I remember I go around noon, and I get dressed, and I'm going to go out and do my next day distance run, and I'm just going to run around, do pulls in the outfield of Hoover Met. And Michael's hitting, and there's probably 15 people out there. and you may have to go fact check, but I think the names of, like, that was back when they had Charlie Lau and other hitting gurus, and obviously Tito and those guys. And so Michael's taking his own batting practice with, you know, what's labeled Pearl Baseballs, presumably sent from above in Chicago. And everybody's just fielding for him. And there's probably 10 people around the batter's cage. You know, people from Chicago, et cetera. He's just working on his craft. So we run for a while, and then I sit in what would have been the Chattanooga dugout. And I can tell, finally, Michael has taken his final round, his final swing. And he comes out of the cage, and I say, well, I guess it's now or never. So I kind of hop up the steps, and I start jogging over to the batter's cage. And I get a few paces from him, and I will never forget this. It's probably only been told 3 or 4 times. I get right up kind of in his shadows, and he looks up and sees me. And I extend my hand, and as I said, I'd met a number of unique people in the baseball world, and I was on a major league roster at the time. And Michael extends his hand, and he's got some big hands. I mean, part of his gifts as an athlete. And I'm getting ready to say, hey, Michael, what's going on? And I say, hey, Mr. Jordan, my name is John Courtright. And I got totally locked up, about swallowed my tongue. And he said, hey, man, I certainly know who you are. You're the guy that threw at my head last night. And I about collapsed on the field. But then he just broke out into a big grin, said, hey, what's going on? Relatively talked like a normal human being that I would be. He is not. And he said, what can I do for you? And I have a signed ball beside my home office and a couple other artifacts from that time. And I certainly cherish it. Occasionally I'll look at it and it will bring me back to these types of things. But I was savvy enough to figure out beating the MJ autograph ban in Birmingham.
And it shows a certain, you know, part of his personality. I mean, because, you know, not everybody who goes 0-for-3 and strikes out a couple of times is going to go sign a ball for the pitcher who did it the next day, especially one who I guess he took the meaning of it, too. He understood that you weren't necessarily throwing at him. But that's not a situation that I think a lot of people would feel comfortable with.
No, and really the easiest way for me to address that is the entire summer and even in the fall, because, you know, baseball ended at the major league level, and that pushed Michael to the Arizona Fall League, which I happened to participate in as well. And Sweeney, I never once to a person heard anything bad about Michael Jordan. He was so gracious with his time. More so, you know, privately with the Birmingham folks, very gracious with, you know, his good fortune in when the minor leagues then and now are not overly gracious in terms of, you know, economic prosperity, and he really worked, you know, through the years. People have alluded to other folks that have tried to drop in, or in certain ways, whether they're a verb I'm looking for, you know, join a sport to see where it takes them. I tell you what, for the most part, Michael Jordan very rarely was secluded or did his own thing. It was amazing how much he was in unison with his team, the opponents, the game as a whole.
You know, John, I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, you and I are roughly the same age. We're about a month apart. You turn 50 next month. I turn 50 a month after you. So we grew up watching Michael Jordan in our, you know, kind of middle school years. He was a star at North Carolina. In high school, he was a star with the Bulls. And you know, when we were in college, he became the superstar, started winning titles. So he is, you know, we're old enough to know exactly who he is and was at that time. And the players who are in the league are also all younger than he's 8 years older than the average player in the Southern League at that point. You know, there had to have been a sense of awe with everybody and trying to work through that just to compete, because once you get around the fact that he's there, this is still your job, John. This is still everybody else's job. Your livelihood is at stake here. A lot of people are trying to get around this fact, and I can't imagine it was easy to just push that aside.
I don't want to say it was easy, but I think if you look at it in a different prism, you know, minor league baseball in May and June and July, it can be about 100 degrees and about 101 humidity. Mm-hmm. And on a Wednesday night, occasionally when you're playing every day, it may not be overly exciting, despite being a professional sport as a participant. But what Michael did was, instead of the awe and the wow that you had to deal with or get over, but he brought every day excitement to the ballpark, whether it was through fans' interest or whatever could happen tonight could reach back home in the news because of what Michael did or did not, you maybe raised your game. And so in some ways, which I think is an undercurrent in sports, you know, when you play against the best, maybe you raise your game. Was he the best baseball player? Maybe, maybe not. But he was the best. And because of that, it brought better focus, maybe better preparation, and frankly, maybe better play.
You were promoted shortly after that. I think you only made three more starts at AA. So did you face him again at all that year or
I did not. I did not. I had, you know, thankfully had the good fortune of getting promoted. And then, you know, as I touch on, and in this week where there's just been so much about him again, I've even gone back on the internet and tried to piece things together. You know, when the game ended in August 8th or 10th, whatever it was, you know, the minor leagues were the only game in town.
Yeah.
And think how fortunate we were to have him as, like, you know, the bell cow of the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
In order to somewhat maybe fill a void between the minor leagues and what was no longer Major League Baseball. And, you know, again, however you view his participation, his role, I mean, he kept the Southern League, but in some extension, a lot of the minor leagues relevant in August and September. And then I went back and looked at some things because I was looking at my fall Arizona League roster and chuckled at some of the names that I had forgotten about. But I saw a blurb that year in the Arizona Fall League, the attendance, I think, was just a tad below what had been the cumulative attendance of all the Arizona Fall League seasons up to that point. And so when you're out in the Arizona Fall League, which is a league that in theory was built by Major League Baseball to have further development for, you know, the next upcoming class of what they think are Major League players, you know, why I was invited, I have no idea, but that's another story. But the idea, those are leagues that if you follow baseball in the fall, there could be four people in the stands, and it could be a mom and a dad and a lady friend. And one fan that's very passionate. To have fans follow Michael in that type of condensed setting, honestly, I have to believe it raised the level of play and raised players' games that probably and hopefully changed their trajectory for the good.
I'm curious where you rank this personally compared to your Moonlight Graham moment. The following year, you made one big league appearance, and it was your last big league appearance. You know, that is certainly the goal of everybody who puts on the uniform, but not everybody got to experience what you did in the Southern League the year earlier. So where do these two events rank for you?
Well, it's interesting. I try to be facetious in telling folks that I don't think when you're lucky enough to get drafted or signed professionally that you wanted the highlight of your career to be a minor league moment.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, upon reflection, it was a very significant thing. And it's, you know, like the world turns sometimes in the business that I'm in now. At one point in time, we had merged with, you know, David Falk and Fame from a sports agency standpoint, had crossed paths with those that are still a part of Michael's life, and Curtis Polk and ST Portnoy and people like that. It's there are like every 8-10 years, something pulls me back, and kind of the totality of that moment it is very unique in my life. And as I meet players, you know, certainly a business card is not defined by moments in life, but, you know, Sweeney, it occasionally gets brought up, or I'll be sitting at a meeting with someone in those darn 30 for 30s run again at the most unique times.
Yeah.
And I'll get like 10 texts from clients or people alike that say, "Hey, I'm watching this show.
Mm-hmm.
Is this you?"
Yeah, that's exactly the way I found you. I mean, I was not intending on this at all. I was watching the 30 for 30 in prep for an interview that I did with Glenn DeSarcina, who was his teammate and the shortstop on the Barons. And as I'm watching and listening, your name is announced by the, you know, by the radio announcer that you talked about, Mr. Bloom. And it just trails off. And all, if I'm not paying attention, I might not hear that name, because that's how brief your mention is in this. But, you know, the wheels start turning and put two and two together, and this is why you and I are talking. So it does come up, I guess, every once in a while for you.
Yep. And I, you know, I'd be remiss, you know, in saying this. You know, I don't want to ask my own questions during a podcast, but, you know, early on, not only that first game, which was the second game, or following it from afar, or talking to guys, because Chattanooga and Birmingham would play quite a bit during the course of the way that the leagues were set up. You know, early on, the levers that made him the best basketball player, whether it was scoring, movement, passing, defensively, he was so gifted physically. Let alone the obvious just knowledge of the game. But those levers, for you and I who are in the baseball world a lot, those aren't always the greatest of attributes. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard for him to get on time. And what I've always held to is when I left him in Birmingham, and then when I saw him play a bunch in Arizona, during what would have been, so that went from April to seeing him again a lot in October, November, and maybe even December during that fall. Mm-hmm. I've said this, if there were no names on the back of the jerseys, by the end of that fall league, I could see a scout have looked at the player and said, "Hey, I think the guy's got a chance playing the big leagues." Mm. Running, throwing, catching. He had smoothed out a lot of those things for the obvious. You know, he just felt more comfortable. He had more repetition. The biggest thing with Michael, like anything, a high school hitter, a college hitter, is just the ability to be a consistent hitter. And, you know, a lot of the studies are that the longer levered, taller guys, it's harder. There are fewer successful guys. And that's the one thing. He was miles and miles better by that fall. But when someone says he would have done this, he would have done that, frankly, Michael probably could do whatever he wanted to do. That would have been the biggest, like, baseball adjustment, is being able to get like the barrel in quickly and keep it through the zone for as long as you possibly can, because that's really the art of hitting.
John, the last thing I want to ask you is about this. You spent your life in the game, and you know, you've seen a ton of people who were gifted, were touted, yet didn't have the ability to go past a certain level in the game, whatever level of the minors, or even reaching the majors and not reaching stardom. There are a lot of reasons people don't succeed, because the game is hard. So given that,
How impressive should it be when, at the time, a lot of people are saying, wow, look at what a lousy baseball player he is. He only hit 202. He hit 202 in double A after not picking up a baseball bat for 13 years, John. I think that gets lost on so many people.
I think it highlights, you know, why there's a 10-part series.
Yeah.
He's unbelievably gifted from a physical standpoint, but his competitiveness and his ability to get literally everything out of those around him is just unheard of. And, you know, my kids this week before the documentary, you know, asked me, they read where Michael maybe said something like, The Last Dance, it may show a part of me that people won't like or something like that. I don't know what exactly was said. And as we watched it, I said, what you guys have to understand is his competitiveness is something that he is so end result driven that he was end result driven that if he's going to do anything, and that's what we've always heard, because when there would be social situations with Michael, like in Phoenix, there was a lot of playing pool in Scottsdale and things like that. And he would invite, just my last aside, he would invite the entire fall league to places that essentially he rented out the entire fall season because he needed some privacy. He needed, in his own way, a detox time. I'll never forget, it was he and Charles Barkley together every night.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first, the baseball world in the fall was all new to the Michael Jordan hysteria. The Southern League kind of then had run its course. And so no one, you know, we started over in terms of, well, can we talk with him? Can we interact with him? Could we hang out with him? And what's interesting is he had gotten to know, like, you'll have to fact check, like Jason Giambis and some people like that through USA Sports stuff. And Jason had said when they were together, Michael was maybe on the dream team or something of that nature, but he always was very real and very normal with the baseball guys. Like, hey, how's things going, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And Jason was on my team in the fall league.
Okay.
And so by the end of it, or within weeks of the Arizona fall league, there were a couple places no longer existing in Scottsdale that Michael literally would say, hey, anybody that wants to come, food and drinks on me, don't sweat it. I just would like to be around people that will just accept me for who I am. But if you're going to come to the big boy pool table, you better bring your game and you better bring your money. And that's how he, I assume, operated in just about everything that he did.
You don't have the ball, do you, that from the strikeout? Do you know where that
No, I don't think so. I have, as I said, a ball and mementos. I just don't know which one it is. And so we'll see. My hopefully my kids don't go out and play catch with it sometime or something like that. But we'll see where that goes. So, Annie.
My thanks to John Courtright, who after a 7-year professional career as a pitcher, went into the legal side of the game. He's a player agent now with ISC, representing Nationals left-hander Patrick Corbin and a number of other major leaguers. If you missed last week's episode, please check out the conversation with Glenn DeSarcina, former shortstop for the Birmingham Barons. You can find that episode and many more on the 30 with Murdy archive at radio.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thank you all for listening, and please continue to stay safe.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches, because the way these ball players are hitting them, yeah, they'd need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.